Hello there, Josh Cohen.
Hey Glenn, Happy New Year to you.
And to you, my friend. Here we are on the first day of 2013, and we've got nothing better to do than to record a conversation for BlockingHeads.tv.
Yeah. Well,
one of us has got to get a life one of these days, Josh.
Yeah, right. What could be
anyway? I'm Glenn
than,
Lowry.
What could be better than that?
Okay, yeah. there's that. We're already doing what we most wish to do. Let's introduce ourselves. I'm Glenn Lowry here at The Glenn Show at BloggingHeads.tv. I teach at Brown University, and I'm talking with Josh Cohen.
Josh Cohen at Stanford University, at Apple University, and editor of Boston Review.
Editor of Boston Review, and we have got to get some time in to discuss the great success that you're having at the magazine and to talk about that. I very much want to do that. But here we are at the end of 2012, the beginning of 2013. 2012 was a momentous year, to be sure. I guess we're obligated, are we not, to do some kind of year-end summary or review or commentary or something. We had this election. President Obama was decisively reelected after much drama. And other such stuff. And we are, even as we speak, awaiting the resolution of these the impasse up on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. about tax and budget matters, the so-called fiscal cliff over which
fiscal
we seem
cliff,
to be about to go.
Yeah.
So we got our plate full here, Josh. What do you think?
We do. We do. Okay. And, you know, and also so much has been said about the election, and so much has been said about the fiscal cliff. I'm not sure that that we're going to have much to add to it. But you know, I mentioned to you I had my wallet stolen, so I spent 3 hours yesterday at the Department of Motor Vehicles in Daly City outside San Francisco. And,
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, well, it was a little bit of a pain, but it gave me an opportunity while I was waiting online, both outside and inside, to spend a lot of my time following fiscal cliff negotiations on Twitter. And, you know, I think I was probably sort of brain dead by the end of it. I mean, every detail and non-detail was being assiduously reported on, and as you said, the fate of the deal that was voted on by the Senate last night is, as we speak, in the hands of the House, and I don't think either of us has any particular insight on how that negotiation is going to go in the House. I guess my one thought about this is that I tried to put myself in the position of kind of looking back, you know, 5 years from now, when virtually all of the details of the political back and forth and most of the details of the deal itself would be, you know, buried in some memory hole or other. And, you know, to ask, you know, so what is, you know, does this, you know, have, what's the larger significance of this? And, you know, two thoughts, you know, both of which have been said, but wait, I think they're right. One is that, you know, I think at the end of the day, the most significant element of the deal is that the Republican Party just voted for a tax increase. Republicans in the Senate, the Republican Party. Republicans in the Senate just voted for a tax increase, which they have for a long time been out of the habit of doing. Now, we can talk about, you know, Obama backing away from the $250,000 line in the sand, you know, getting 600,000 instead of the 800,000 that he would have preferred to get. But, and, you know, and I don't, those are not completely, those are not trivial matters. And the, you know, backing off from the line in the sand may prove to be important down the road in the next negotiation. But, you know, I do think that there's something pretty important about the fact that the Republican in the Senate voted for a tax increase. And, you know, that, after all, is was the place, that, you know, what this last election was fought over, to the extent that it was fought over anything. And, so I think it's that. I think that is something that's kind of that's pretty significant. You know, the
so
other.
So then, all we need then is for the Democrats to find a way of supporting some kind of restrictions and limits on spending, and we'll be on the road to solving the problems. No? I mean, you say it's significant that the Republicans, or at least Republicans in the Senate, voted to increase somebody's taxes, albeit on people over, what is it, 400,000? Or
I don't even know
the details. But
only people,
okay.
Yeah.
I grant that, but that's necessary but not sufficient is the point I'm making. And it's not just Republicans who are recalcitrant here. I think I can be safe in saying that.
I agree with you about that. But then, you know, if you look at the efforts to get, you know, some larger deal to deal with the long-term structural deficits, I think there has been much more flexibility, for better or worse, on the Democratic side, you know, at least on Obama's side, and that, you know, very considerable hurdle and may still be an impassable barrier in the House, but very considerable hurdle to making any progress, I think, has been this, now basically a 30-year long trouble that the Republicans have had with the tax increases. And I think this represents a significant change. I agree with you that there is, and this is really the second point, there is something pretty dispiriting about the process here, that at the very last second this bill gets through the Senate and it still hasn't gotten through the House, and it is very much a short-term measure, the habit of kicking the can down the field is reinforced here, but I resist the idea that, you know, we've talked about this before. I resist the idea that it's a kind of, you know, everybody's equally at fault. I just don't think that that's true.
I think
this has been a big hurdle. So yeah,
we had an election and the Democrats won. I mean, the president won.
Yeah.
And all of this was being bandied about during the campaign, and the voters have spoken, and it didn't look close to me. So,
the election wasn't close, no.
No, and I mean, the endorsement of the arguments of the election. I can recall, I think, in conversation with you, and I know it with others at Blogging Heads, lamenting what I refer to as the demagoguery of the Democratic presidential campaign against a man who happened to make a lot of money in business and happened to be pretty effective at, buying and selling companies. And some of them went under and some of them did well. And he and his partners made a lot of money. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. I didn't think the idea that somebody had high income was disqualifying and all that. And yet this candidate was portrayed as, you know, out of touch, as a guy who just wanted to take care of his rich buddies, as a guy who had, you know, Cayman Island bank accounts and multiple houses and elevators and, you know, didn't care about the 47% and whatnot. And that guy got his hat handed to him. So it sounded to me like the people were saying, it is about the middle class. Yeah, we do need to raise taxes on the rich. You know, it seemed to me that they were saying, if I had to choose between a community organizer and a guy who bought and sold companies and turned them over to make money for himself, I'd trust the community organizer who has my values at heart any day of the week. That felt to me like a kind of definitive statement coming from the American people about what they value and what they want from their government.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if I think it's probably fair to say that the Republicans, at least in the Senate, had their ear to the ground. And as you say, there was an election and the national election spoke pretty clearly, if on nothing else, on this one thing, which is about, you know, really, and here I want to agree with you very much, it's not about whether increased taxes on top income or in the top 1% or 2% or, you know, 5% or whatever should be, are the entire solution. But whether they're part of the solution. And also, I think there's another point, which is, are they part of the solution, and should the people who've been benefiting the most take the lead in contributing to the solution? You know, I don't think anybody thinks that this is not a long-term solution to the problems of long-term structural budget deficits. Whether those issues should be so forcefully on the table right now is another matter that we can talk about. But I don't think anybody thinks this is a long-term solution, but that this is part of the solution, and that there's a responsibility to be a kind of first mover. That I think the election did speak to, and I think the Republicans may have been Republicans in the Senate may have been listening to it.
I don't think just one detail
in the things that you said about Romney, the criticism, first of all, the criticisms about what Romney said about the 47%, Romney said it about the 47%. Nobody put those words in his mouth. And what he said was pretty awful, I think, though he didn't really back off on it after the election so much. But it was pretty bad, and eventually the words came to haunt him. But I think the main thing was not that he was a wealthy guy who had made a bunch of money. The criticisms were focused on the ways that he had made his money. And we can debate whether those are good ways or bad ways, but I don't think it was here's somebody who's a successful business guy. It was that his
success. Yeah, I didn't think there was... Yeah. I didn't think there was anything wrong with the way he made his money. Okay, that was my position then. It's my position now. I think that's a necessary function in a churning, capitalist creative destruction world. I think somebody's got to do it. I'd rather live in a world in which I had private equity and these kind of, takeover, remake, reshuffle, and restructure artists than if I didn't have them, because sometimes companies do need to be streamlined. They do need to be what aspects of them can be functional salvaged, and that which is no longer economically viable scuttled.
Yeah.
Maximizing employment and nobody ever losing their job is a stupid and self-defeating economic strategy. Yeah. These are all things that I believe. So,
right. So I guess what I think, what's fair to say is that Romney was kind of blamed personally. There was kind of finger wagging at him personally for some general directions of the American economy, of American capitalism over the last 30 years. Decline of manufacturing, lots of outsourcing, higher rates of unemployment, increasing inequality, and the sense was there's some, financialization of the economy, lots of ways of making money that don't directly contribute, that don't directly produce stuff,
right,
that don't produce great products, and you know, I think there's a kind of disquiet, there is a kind of disquiet about all of that. And, you know, Romney was made to represented all of that, whether it's a, you know, an important part of successful capitalism or not, I think is another matter, but that it's become excessive. There's the sense that it's that those elements of the economy have become excessive, and that there are greater opportunities for making money by flipping companies than making money by producing great products, and that's regrettable. You know, and that I think is true. I don't think that's Romney's fault.
Well, that's where I was going. I don't see that there's any policy implication of that observation. To me, that's like lamenting, structural economic transformations that are going on globally under pressure of integrated markets, rapid economic development in low-wage countries, technological innovation, reduction in the cost of communication and transportation, the ability to coordinate economic activity over a large amount of space in this information age. These are just facts about the world. I mean, I don't, it's like pushing on a string to say that, you know, I wish that we could go back to a time when, you know, I don't know, maybe the financial sector is too big and maybe there's some tax cum regulation framework that can get us to a world in which, you know, engineers are more highly compensated than financial analysts, and the amount of GDP growth that's coming from the buying and selling security sector is half of what, you know, it is today or something like that. But I don't know what those policies are, and everything that I've heard people propose along those lines makes me gives me a lot of second thoughts and makes me worry about, you know, killing the golden goose, you know, somehow impeding the engine of economic growth and prosperity with overregulation and so on. So, I mean, I don't know. Did you have something concrete in mind by way of reform that would make Bain Capital a less prominent, a Bain Capital type enterprise, a less prominent part of our economic scene?
Well, this is a long conversation. I do think that if you consider public investment in education, including in community college education, with strong relations between community college education and employment opportunities. Consider investment, that kind of investment in education / training. You consider investment in infrastructure. Consider investment in R&D. I think there is it's an open question what a successful alternative to the economic policies of the last 30 years looks like. But I think it's fair to say that there's been an underinvestment in those longer-term sources of economic prosperity, and I think one thing that's true is that if you're going to do any of that, and this goes back to the earlier conversation about what's happening with the significance of the issues around the fiscal cliff, if you're going to do any of that, you need to have more revenue than current tax policy is providing. And if you have people who there's got to be more public spending in order to achieve that. You have to have greater public spending. And if your goal is the 30-year goal of starve the beast, cut taxes, drive deficits, then say the budget is a disaster, then you're not going to get any of that. I think is
what we agree, Josh, that the public sector is necessary and that it has to be paid for. But the point I'm making is that it seems to me a lot of the anxiety reflected in people's distaste for the activities of a Bain capital and a Mitt Romney, and embrace of the rhetoric of a Barack Obama, comes from the fact that private sector unionism is down, is under, what, 10%? It's under 10% of the national
under
workforce
10%.
Now, private sector unionism.
Yeah.
That manufacturing is, you know, a pale shadow of what it used to be in many communities around this country, and stuff like that. And, you know, I mean, I just don't see that being turned around by any of this. And, I mean, I just
by any of what?
Energy. By any of the what you just got through endorsing, you said we needed a more vital public sector. You said we needed to invest in infrastructure. You said we needed to build up education that was relevant to employment for modestly skilled persons and allow people to retool and things like that. And I said, and you said, and we needed to raise taxes to pay for it. And I said, I'm for that. I see the importance of a vital public sector, but that globalization, low-wage competition from China, India, or wherever, declining unionism, and the end of the sense of security that people can have in their economic situation throughout their lifetimes, and all of that are facts of the modern economic world, which are not themselves reversed by, or at least as far as I can see, would be reversed by the kinds of you know, investment-oriented and growth-oriented public sector-centered policies, which you were, and I was going to give green energy promotion as an example, without trying to rehearse the debates of the campaign, but just to observe that, you know, it doesn't look to me like policy that the president endorsed coming into office and attempted to pursue of, I'm going to use the word, picking winners, that is to say, making large federally subsidized loans or grants to companies in order to get them jump-started in a global competition to get a position in the solar panel market or whatever it might be, has been spectacularly successful. Yes, the auto bailout did keep companies afloat and avoid what might have been a significant hit in terms of lost employment. As an industrial policy, as a kind of broad strategy of economic management and growth, I didn't see much promise there either. So,
I think it's So on the auto stuff, again, complicated issues. I think it's a little bit tendentious to say to keep companies afloat. I mean, GM is doing pretty well. It's not just that a bunch of jobs were saved. The company is doing. I think they're doing reasonably well. The focus in the campaign on, you know, the issues about Solyndra. I mean, you know, it's, look, if you go down the road of providing subsidies for a bunch of companies, some of them are going to do well and some of them are not going to do well. That's not a net assessment about whether or not the policy of supporting new energy investment makes sense. I also think the characterization that you give of globalization is beginning to feel a little bit, what can I say, out of date. I mean, you know, low wage competition from China, yes, but as you know, if you grow 10% a year, you double GDP per capita every 7 years. So,
you're breaking up on the audio a little bit.
Wages in China. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, wages. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you now.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah, I mean, wages in China are still, you know, lower than they are in the, certainly much lower than they are in the United States. But the Chinese advantage as a consequence of lower compensation is diminishing. And I think it's widely agreed that the big advantages that China has now are less about low wages. And more about, for example, things like the sheer supply of engineers. as well as returns to, you know, agglomeration that, you want to buy screws, you can get screws from the screw place down the block. And those are things that I think are, you know, amenable to address, maybe they're amenable to address through public policy. So I think the, you know, the idea that it's, it's all about, arbitrage on low wages, I don't think that's really quite where we are now. And I really don't think that that's where we're going to be, 5 to 10 years. So preparing I don't want to exaggerate the cases of the return of manufacturing to the United States, but there is some return, and it's understandable why there's some return, because those advantages of that come from low wage competition are diminishing. And you can say that that's the success of globalization, is that there's been some kind of convergence, and whatever the source of it is, I think those the policy terrain has changed some as a consequence of the diminution of those advantages. So,
okay, let me ask you something else, Josh. How do you feel about the discussion of poverty during the election?
You'll have to remind me. I forgot about that part.
That would be my point.
I mean, look, I know. We could spend the rest of this conversation talking about all the things that were not talked about during the election.
Well, how about if we just spend 5 minutes talking about poverty? Because, if you say we're all in this together, and so the rich have to pay their fair share, it seems to me that there's something else that goes along with this. We're all in this together. If you say you didn't build that, again, not to parse the rhetoric of the campaign, but just to say, if the point is someone who succeeds in private business also stands on the shoulders of others who have, through the public sector, contributed to the creation of an infrastructure and a institutional context within which their private business can flourish. So you didn't build that on your own. You built that in part with the help of the American people. Then don't you also have to say about people who live in the corners and the backwaters and the hovels of rural and urban America, the black and the white and the brown and yellow people who are just holding on by their fingernails and don't have enough money, who can't get their kids decent nutrition, decent education, who don't live in safe communities and who don't have much hope for the future, that they didn't fail on their own, that if schools don't work for poor people, that's a failure of the society and not of the poor people, and so on like that. I mean, so isn't there something lopsided about the claim to collective responsibility and mutuality, which only points at the rich paying their fair share and is fearful of offending the so-called middle class, and therefore avoids pointing out the fact that there are people who really, really need help in this country. They're not middle class, they're poor. And middle class, not only rich people, should be sacrificing in order to create something called equal opportunity for the most disadvantaged in our society. End of rant, but you see what I'm getting at.
No, it's not a rant at all. I see what you're getting at, and I completely agree with it. I think it's... the political philosopher in me comes at this from thinking about Rawls and Rawls's views. And Rawls's views are so far outside the space of political debate. In this election or in recent elections, so far outside, and in two fundamental ways. One of them is, there's a lot on the equal opportunity side. So there's a lot of rhetoric about equality of opportunity, and everybody shares it. That's the American civic religion. There was once a survey that was done. I think John Zaller reports it in a book of is from about 20 years ago or so, where it was something like 96% of Americans say they believe in equality of opportunity. It's like more Americans than believe in God believe in equality of opportunity. Of course, people have very different ideas about what equality of opportunity requires. And Rawls has a very strong principle of equality of fair opportunity is what he calls it. And the idea is essentially where you end up should not depend on where you start out. Your fate in life shouldn't be inherited. It should, you know, people should have some kind of equality at the starting gate and then, you know, make it or not make it based on their ambitions and their abilities. But, you know, where they began in terms of family background, community, et cetera, shouldn't shape their fate in life. Now, we're not only a million miles away from that in reality, and increasingly far from that reality, but I don't think that there are the kinds of, you know, policies that you know, you need in order to achieve that. And I think the, you know, the most notably, most recently, you know, the kind of compromise that was achieved in the Senate version of the fiscal cliff bill on inheritance taxes is a case in point. But even more than that, and that even more than that, you know, Rawls says when you're trying to measure the justness of a society, you should adopt the point of view of the least advantaged. Basically, what he means by that is the bottom quintile in the income distribution. And when he's defending that view, the, you know, a leading alternative to that is, you know, measure by the average income. Well, that's the middle class. So the middle class view is that you should evaluate policy in terms of the middle class. That's the position that Rawls is, a position that Rawls
rejects,
is arguing against when he says, you know, judge by whether or not the inequalities contribute to the maximum benefit of people who are in the least advantaged position. Now we can, you know, there are, you know, is that right? Is that not right? Is that the right conception of justice, et cetera, et cetera? We can have an interesting argument about that. The point that I'm making, and here I'm agreeing with you, is that that perspective is completely missing, even as a rhetorical outlook from the Democratic Party, and certainly missing from the rhetoric Obama's. So I think that's, and I think that's a,
and I
a,
find,
since I find the Rawlsian view plausible, I find it's a, I think it's a real deficiency.
Okay, so now I'm not a political philosopher, but I have read A Theory of Justice, and taught it. In fact, in collaboration with a philosopher friend of mine, Charles Griswold. Do you know Charles Griswold?
He
was my colleague
wonderful
at Boston University for many years.
Yeah.
He's wonderful. Yeah. Interesting philosopher, and we team taught together a couple of years, and so, you know, I've studied the text, and I always thought, okay, there's the normative argument, the principled argument, we're going to deduce on a set of axioms or, you know, assumptions or you know, sort of postulates, conclusions that follow logically about the nature of social justice, democratic order. I always thought there was a missing piece, and the missing piece was implementation. That is, knowing is not the same as doing, right? So having produced an argument that might be more or less compelling on behalf of certain principles, how would I actually get those principles implemented? How would I get them that? So democracy, it seems to me, militates powerfully against the difference principle, powerfully against this idea that you should view justice in society from the perspectives of the least off, because democracy pushes everything into the middle. You know, Anthony Downs, you know, median voter type competition. I want to get to this guy's right if he's left of center, because if I get a little bit to his right and he's left of center, more than the center is going to be on my side and I'm going to win the election. That definitely doesn't implement a bottom oriented approach to public policy. And given that we can't count on democratic process to produce the outcome that philosophic reflection suggests is just, it seems to me that a very important role for leadership, exhortation, a kind of artful compelling, emotively, you know, gripping articulation of principle is there, and therefore, and so, the absence of that kind of leadership from the Democratic Party, I won't put this only at the feet of the president, is especially troubling to me, you know. So, anyway.
Yeah,
we'll never get to what Rawls recommends if we just follow along trying to win the next election, is what I'm saying.
I absolutely agree with that. The one thing that I think maybe I would put a little bit differently from the way you did is that I think it's a, I wouldn't maybe put so much weight on the issue about leadership, although I'm not hostile to that idea. I think the issue about whether you implement or execute a more egalitarian conception of justice through democratic process depends on what people think is at stake in the democratic process. If everybody regards politics and democratic politics in particular as a vehicle, a venue for the pursuit of their interests and the use of their power to pursue their interests, and you certainly are not going to get anything like the difference principle implemented through democratic process. People in the democratic process have to themselves be motivated by concern to achieve some kind of civic equality, they have to be acting on their sense of justice in the democratic process. Lord knows they're not acting on their sense of justice typically when they're making economic decisions. So if they're not going to do that, it's all the more important. You know, and that's true whether you're talking about, Mitt Romney or anybody else. People are not going to act, acting on their sense of justice when they're making economic choices in the market. So it makes it all the more important that people have a vivid, animating sense of justice that they act on in the political process. And that's the only hope of achieving anything like a Rawlsian justice, assuming that's what you want to achieve. It's the only hope of achieving that in the democratic process. So I think leadership is important there, people do help to political leaders do help to set the terms of debate, and they help to change the space of discussion from one in which some people are talking about the injustice of poverty, and to one in which people are just talking about the middle class. Leaders have a role to play there, but it's an absurd over-exaggeration of the political responsibility of intellectuals, but it's also partly the responsibility of intellectuals to engage those issues and to the limited extent to which it's possible, to infuse democratic politics with ideas about justice that are not going to be achieved if politics is just about acting, using your power to pursue your interests.
Well, that brings us, I think, conveniently as a segue to the world of, organs where intellectuals spout off their various thoughts about justice and war and peace and literature and poetry and all of that, politics and, you're the editor of the Boston Review.
I am.
And I was just made aware of the Boston, and I serve on the editorial, what do you call us? Contributing editor?
Editor. You're a contributing
editor. I'm on the masthead at Boston. Very proud to be a part of the Boston Review.
Yes, editor.
You guys have had a fabulous year, 2012. I thought it would, having you on the Glenn Show, it would be remiss if we didn't hear from you a little bit about how Boston Review is doing and what 2012 meant to the magazine, and what kind of stuff you've been publishing there, and you know, how's it going?
Well, I've been doing this since editing the review since 1991. Since 2002, I do it with my very good friend, co-editor, colleague, Deb Chasman. It is a good segue from where we were in the previous conversation, because I did start doing this back in 91 because I thought it was important to draw connections between the kind of intellectual ferment that you find in, among intellectuals and public political discussion. And I was particularly concerned about the fact that I thought I couldn't really find a publication where I agreed both with the point of view of the publication and the style of discussion and argument in the publication. I thought that things that are, you know, more politically on the left, the positions that I endorsed, tended to be a little kind of screechy and a little insular and a little, here's what we, you know, the enlightened think about these issues, and that there was not enough weight put on the old kind of enlightenment values of, you know, argument and evidence. So I kind of, you know, thought of the magazine as something that would be a point of connection between important intellectual discussions in the academy and among non-academic intellectuals and some larger public political conversation. And you know, it's, as you know, publishing is pretty tough. The old models don't really work anymore, and that's true for us as it is for everybody else, and how exactly to balance print publication with social media, with web presence, with tablet versions of magazines. These are all live and difficult issues, but we did, you know, I feel proud, a sense of pride in what we've done. We've published lots of good stuff.
Tell me about a few of the pieces you guys published in the last year that you're most proud of, that you think are really making a difference.
Yeah. So a couple of things.
Oh, by the way, Josh, excuse me for interrupting, but we should just tell viewers that they can log on and go to bostonreview.org. Is it?
BostonReview.net.
.net, I beg your pardon.
BostonReview.net. And we have, you know, this is part of our big challenge. Since 1996, we have put all of our content online for free. And the reason for that is that's why we're in business, is to, you know, have people engage with the content. And so it's, you don't make a lot of money when you put it online for free, no matter how much traffic you get. You get some, you know, advertising.
But you're still publishing, and you didn't go into this for money. So, so far, so good. Knock on wood.
We're still publishing. It's always a struggle, but we're still publishing. One of the things that we published this last year that, which is really very much connected to the issues that we were just talking about. We had a forum about social mobility with a lead article by Jim Heckman. The University of Chicago economist. And let me just say,
The Nobel laureate as well.
Nobel laureate Jim Heckman. We published these forums where we have a lead article and then a bunch of responses to the lead article. And the idea of those is to express, to capture the fact that there is reasonable and important disagreement that people have. It's like blogging heads, people who are, you know, thoughtful and sensible and, you know, not mass murderers or anything, have, you know, honest disagreements about lots of important sure. topics. And we want to show what that disagreement looks like and, you know, discipline the conversation by having somebody write something, a bunch of people respond from different points of view, and then people respond to, and then the lead author responds to the to those critical reactions. So Jim wrote something on a topic that he's been interested in for a long time, which is about social mobility and really equality of opportunity. And, you know, he's yes. been engaged for a long time, very troubled by the fact that very early in life, as a consequence of nothing that that kids are responsible for, very early right. in life, kids and, you know, some kids end up on a fast track and some kids end up facing lots of hurdles.
Indeed.
And, you know, but economic inequality is part of it, and the amount of time that people have to invest, resources that people have to invest in their kids is a part of it, and the number of words kids hear by the time they're 2 years old is a part of it. So he's been an advocate a strong advocate of early childhood interventions, and he thinks, right. This is something that he develops in the piece, that there's a very good evidence from a couple of programs that have been studied very carefully, including a program called ABC Darien, a couple of programs that early childhood interventions really do make a long-term difference in,
right.
In life chances. And so to that extent, those early interventions, you know, supplemented by later interventions, but those early interventions are more effective than trying to do something, you know, when kids get to be, you know, 14 or 16, and you have this accumulation of difficulties up until then. So Jim did this piece, which, as I say, is really fundamentally about those issues about equality of opportunity that we were talking about before. And then we had a host of responses to Jim's argument, ranging from Charles Murray, whose work on the bell yeah. curve Jim has been very critical of, to
yeah.
Jeffrey Canada. We had the teachers who joined in the discussion. And it yeah. was I think it was a very fruitful conversation about the merits of early, this strategy of focusing on early childhood intervention as a way to advance the cause of equality of opportunity. And also, you know, as Jim would be the first to say, it's, you know, it's not just equality of opportunity in a fairness way, but you're also losing out on the contributions
yeah.
of a whole bunch of
it's
people.
It's efficiency.
So there, you get there's an efficiency element to it as well.
This is one of the areas, Josh, where equality and efficiency are not in conflict with each other. In the classic yeah. formulation of the problem of distribution of economic benefit in a society, one needs to think about a trade-off, because the instruments that you have at hand to promote equality are all in one way or another likely to impede efficiency. If I tax someone and then transfer resources, I create a disincentive to the person who's better off to produce, because he doesn't get the full value of the dollar because of taxes,
right.
and that generates
right.
inefficiency. Right. But here is a win-win. Here's an opportunity to have more equality and more efficiency, because there's waste. There are yeah. human resources that are failing to be developed when interventions early enough in the life cycle could promote their development, the consequence of which would be both less poverty right. and more output for the society. And I just want to say about James Heckman, whose Nobel Prize derives from his relatively early econometric theory work that he did,
yeah.
developing methods for solving certain kinds of statistical problems in panel data, cross-section data, and cross-section over time data. Jim Heckman was famous for some of his very clever and extremely useful innovations in that area, and he was given a Nobel Prize. I don't think they give two Nobel Prizes to the same person, but he could well be a very strong contender for a Nobel recognition for what he's been doing these last 10, 15 years, and really laying bare the kind of empirical, scientific basis for the opinions that you've just been describing. These claims about what happens if you intervene and what good it'll do and whether it pays off more than what it cost and whether it changes life courses and are people more malleable, these are all empirical claims. And they're not easy to pin down. They require...
Not easy at all.
I mean, he's taught himself a lot of psychology. He's collaborated with developmental psychologists. He's really, really pushed the envelope and expanded the horizon for research on these problems. So I have nothing but respect for Jim Heckman, whom I'm going to see in a couple of days out in San Diego at the American Economic Association meeting.
Oh, right, right.
He's chairing a panel that I'm presenting a paper on. So I'm a big fan of Jim's and was so happy to see a serious intellectual magazine read by a non-professional, that is non-economics audience, featuring that level of and quality of discussion about these problems. I think the magazine did a real public service in publishing.
Yeah, I thought it was, I was very, as I say, pleased and proud. And also there was a wide-ranging, you know, set of interesting set of criticisms. But the meticulousness, you know, I'm not saying whether Jim is right on the details or wrong is another matter. But I can tell you that, as you know, just to reinforce what you were just saying, that there was an incredible level of meticulousness, of care about getting, you know, it's really important to get things right. Now, that may seem obvious, but I can tell you when you're trying, you know, and this is when you're trying to sell magazines, the number of people, the number of pressures you're under to say, you know, yeah, it's important to get things right, but you also got to sell magazines and you got to, you know, make things clearer than truth and you have to shade them and, you know, make them more, you know, exciting and sexy. If you're, you know, there are a million pressures like that and they're real and they're significant, but you got to, so you have to push back hard on, you know, the idea that, you know, at the end of the day, it's important to get it right. One of the things I should say that I was most pleased by, a thing that I was pleased by in publishing the Heckman thing was somebody wrote on the comments page on the article, they said, gee, that this was the first time they'd ever seen anything of Heckman's that didn't have any equations in it. And it was true. You know, we cut all of them out.
He sent you equations, but you didn't publish them.
There were equations in what we were in the material we were working from, but by the way, I mean Jim, as you could imagine, there was not a space, a period, a comma, a semicolon that he didn't scrutinize. So we ended up with no equations in the article, but we weren't putting one over on him. I mean, he thought that the argument. The essay as written got his point of view across without any, if I can put it this way, unnecessary chicken scratching. It really got to the heart of the issues, including the thing that you were just saying about this being an area of policy where trade-offs between equity and efficiency are, you know, arguably not in place. But, and this I think is also to our earlier conversation, this is not all, this is not a set of concerns, a focus that you're going to get to if you start with the assumption that it's all about the middle class. Because the kids who he's concerned about, who are being excluded from opportunities, to all of our detriment, but to an unfairness to them in particular, they're generally not kids who fit the standard, you know, middle class picture. They're often kids from poor backgrounds. And if you don't recognize, if you operate with this completely amorphous idea of, you know, the middle class, which covers everybody from, you know, somebody who's you know, who's got a single mom who's making $24,000 a year, up to somebody who, at least as of last night, is making $399,999 a year. You're not really going to, you know, you're not going to get at these issues. There was another piece in I mentioned a really lovely piece in our top 10 for the year by a philosopher, Canadian, actually Brazilian background, but now teaches philosophy in Canada, a guy named Carlos Frankel. And yes, it's about this policy in Brazil instituted, really reinstituted in 2008, where kids in high school have to study philosophy for 3 years. And this was an older requirement, which the military government had eliminated in 1971, and it was restored. And it restored really for a civic purpose. The idea was that kids are going to become better citizens if they've engaged with the kind of critical thinking that you get even in a high school philosophy class. And it's a very interesting. I mean, is that true? Are people better citizens? I don't know. Nobody's run the experiment, and I'm not recommending running the experiment. But that is the official purpose of this, is to encourage a more thoughtful civic engagement. And it's a requirement on everybody. And one of the things that's interesting, that I found interesting about his piece, which is filled rich with stories, as you might well imagine, professional philosophers don't like this idea. They think that it's, you know, somehow
you have to dumb it down.
You got to dumb it down too much, and you're losing what's really special about philosophy. So the high school teachers who teach this stuff, face these dilemmas that they're kind of looked down on by the people in the profession. But there is something, you know, for somebody who believes that it's a very good policy, I like the policy, there's something very attractive about the stories about kids engaging with Plato's ideas about justice or about the relationship between God's will and virtue. And
I was going to say, let me join the discussion of the econometrician James Heckman with the Citizen Philosophers piece by Carlos Frankel and suggest a research project. You say it hasn't been studied. Well, you may know about the studies of economic students, college students, who some of whom have taken economics and some of whom have not taken. And the investigator brings them into a laboratory and gets them to play a game like the dictator game, where they get a dollar and they decide how much to keep and how much to give to a Confederate. And they can keep the whole thing for themselves, or they can give away half of it or whatever, you know, the kind of measures in their behavior in the laboratory, their sense of fairness and all of that. And you have students who've taken economics and students who haven't. And studies have shown that students with an experience of having taken economics are generally much less fair and much more sort of self-serving in the playing of this laboratory game. I could envision a similar undertaking where you had some students who'd been exposed in high school to philosophy courses and others who hadn't, and you create some artificial situation, but nevertheless revealing, in which they get to interact with each other, and you see whether or not there are systematically different patterns of behavior in the students who've actually had the instruction, and you're able to infer from that if there is any traction with respect to the quality of citizenship produced by exposing students early in their pedagogic development to serious ideas about philosophy. I think it could be done. You know,
I feel like the experimentalist in me is is worrying about the selection problems but I think, look, we have a very nice piece that's, I don't want to give away too much of the future, but a very nice piece coming up by, that hasn't been published yet, by Pranab Bardhan, the development economist from Berkeley,
who's
written for us a bunch before. And this is a piece which is, among other things, on the Banerjee and Duflo book, Poor Economics. It's also on Acemoglu and Robinson's book. It's a review of a bunch of recent big books.
Excellent. I'm very much looking forward to seeing
that. Yeah. And it's terrific, as you can imagine. Pranab is very thoughtful, but he doesn't love the experimentalist turn in development economics. So he has some, he kind of likes the Banerjee and Duflo and Dean Carlin book, Apple book, which is also in the review. He's pretty critical.
He dislikes them. Dislikes them. He's critical of them. Okay.
Yeah. He's pretty critical of the experimentalist enthusiasm. Like nobody ever had learned anything before development economics became so experimental. But there is a piece also that's among our top 10 for the year. There's another forum in the magazine that's also goes to these issues about the relationship, markets and morals. It's Michael Sandel, the Harvard political theorist, did a lead piece for a forum about the limits of markets, about what kinds of goods shouldn't be commodified, and part of his concern. And it's related to the kinds of experiments that you were just describing. It's two or three steps away, but in the general space. Part of the concern that he has is about how when you trade things in markets, the trading them in markets crowds out norms. The classic story here on this being the titmus on different ways
about blood donation.
About blood donations. The British, you do it voluntarily. The Americans, it's done through a market. In England, there's a much broader provision of blood. The blood donations provide more blood than in the American case. Michael has long. Sandel has long expressed these concerns about the excessive spread of markets in contrast with preserving areas where people are deliberating together about what goods are important and why they're important. And we had a lively set of responses to his thing, including from Matt Welch from Reason. Magazine.
Indeed.
And also from your colleague, John Tomasi, who's a very thoughtful Hayekian, libertarian, critical of Michael. So these are all places where, we're doing the kinds of things that we do, where we try to have serious debate in the best sense of the term, not in the debater sense, but in the best sense of about important issues of public policy. Well, but we don't just do that. There's also
No, you're waxing eloquent about Boston Review. Go ahead.
Yeah,
you don't just do serious.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, there's also a lovely interview that my colleague Paula Boya, who teaches at Stanford. Did with Juno Diaz. Juno is the fiction editor for Boston Review. He's been doing it for about 10 years now, and he's a wonderful writer, fantastic writer. Won the Pulitzer Prize, got a MacArthur Genius Fellowship this year. There was a nice New York Times Magazine profile about him, and the interview with him is an exploration of what he describes as kind of decolonial love. Juno is, he's a fantastic person, a wonderful guy, and has been incredibly generous for a decade now in working as our fiction editor for Boston Review with a lot of other demands on his time. But he's got a combination of a kind of a very, you know, romantic sensibility about authentic love with a very kind of down-to-earth sensibility about the temptations that lead people away from romantic love, but also more particularly an articulation of the experience of Dominican culture and what he describes as the kind of rape culture of the Dominican Republic and the colonial legacy that helped to shape that culture. And the difficult, it's, and the interview is an exploration, which he talks about the difficulties of escaping from that and how he explores those difficulties in his fiction. And the most fundamental difficulty is to acknowledge the way, as he's describing it, is to acknowledge the ways in which you have internalized that and are implicit in the reproduction of the colonial culture and in the case, I can't even describe it as the rape culture, and how that it, confronting that within yourself is so fundamental to achieving the kind of, you know, authentic colonial love. So it's a, it's a, I find it a very attractive, I mean, it's a very, the sensibility
what is
a
tell
very
us,
attractive kind of, yeah.
Josh, don't just tease us. Tell us what decolonial love is.
I wish I could say exactly what it is. It's his term, decolonial love, and he also describes it as, you know, authentic love. It's, I think it's, I mean, frankly, it's, I think, what I would just straight up call love. It's an attachment to another person, taking that other person fully seriously, meeting them on their own terms, seeing that reciprocated, you know, an emotional and a passionate attachment, an attachment to that particular person. I think it's what we would, he calls decolonial love. I would call it just love, but it's what he describes his fiction as an exploration of the, particularly coming from the Dominican culture that he comes from. He describes the hurdles to achieving that, and in particular the hurdles that come from having internalized the kind of disrespect and the what again describes as the rape a rape culture, and he talks in, about how it was a set, particularly for him, growing up as a writer, it was a set of women writers of color who,
women of color writers. I saw that. Alice Walker and others.
Alice Walker and Maxine Hong Kingston and others who were able to confront write about the ways in which you needed to confront these issues in your own person, and not just join a, you know, some larger collective project, some nationalist project, in order to achieve decent personal relationships. And what I find interesting about the interview with Juno is that he not only explores those ideas, some in the abstract, but he talks about the hard work of turning abstractions like the ones that we're talking about now into compelling stories, into compelling fiction, and the false starts and the hundreds and thousands of pages that end up on the cutting room floor and the psychological challenges of getting yourself completely inside the characters you're writing about, while at the same time bearing in mind, maybe in the back of your mind eventually, these, you know, broadly philosophical themes about love and power that are, you know, animating what you're doing. Anyway,
Sounds wonderful, Josh. I think we need to conclude, Josh. We're past an hour here. I mean, you were just saying that Boston Review is a place where serious intellectual argument can take place. People don't have to agree, but they do need to be serious. I like to think of the Glenn Show as, in a very small way, a similar kind of place. So I'm inspired by what you guys are doing at Boston Review, and I'm grateful that you were able to come on today and talk with us about it.
Thanks so much for having me, Glenn, and I'm absolutely in agreement that the Glenn Show operates in the same spirit. Really pleased to be on it.
Thank you, Josh. We'll do it again. All right. Okay, take care now.
Very good.
Bye-bye.